You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Yes, good afternoon and welcome to the first ever live radio broadcast of It's More Than Food on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michelle Nashan, and thanks for joining me on this Valentine's Day, and how appropriate, because I believe that food is love. And I have with me today the one and only Lori Silverbush, who's a co-producer of an amazing new movie on hunger in America called A Place at the Table, and the one and only Janet Papendieck, who is a professor of sociology at City College, Hunter College's City College, right?
Hunter City College, University. City University.
Thank you very much. Awesome. Lori, are you there? How are you?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Michelle. Hi,
hey.
Dan. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, awesome. Listen, welcome. And I want to share with you both today. Jan was actually with us. Great start to Valentine's Day. Earlier today, Columbia University's Teachers College established the Lori M. Tisch Center for Food, Education, and Policy.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah, really, really cool. And, well, you know, Lori Tisch is just so awesome because she's really thinking ahead of the curve. She's really looking at what can happen within communities and bringing together, you know, academia, academic institutions like Columbia University's Teachers College, the public health community, chefs, nonprofit groups on the ground, and just really looking at what can happen to make permanent change in communities. So that was really, really
exciting.
Well,
then we're really coming full circle because I went to Tisch for my film degree. So there you go.
Oh, that's awesome. And then, you know, Rick Luftglass, he's the executive director there, also announced their Healthy Food and Community Change Initiative, which is a public-private partnership including sectors of public health, housing, nutrition, farming, grassroots nonprofit, to create these lasting healthy communities through food. So, you know, we applaud them. They're investing $15 million in this initiative, and you know, that's the type of fortitude that we need to see in a single city to really get some work done. So I don't know if your hands are near a phone, Lori, but if we can clap for a second, you know, just
clapping.
Jan's got her hands up to the microphone. Yay!
Nice.
Thank Jack Inslee for adding some applause from the booth. So anyway, let's really kind of dig our teeth into this. You know, we have an interesting show in store for everybody, you know, because we're really looking at the fact that when we say that food is love, and we think about so many people that are going to be going to restaurants this Valentine's Day and taking their lover out you know, really having a great meal, and the security that that brings, we have almost 50 million people in America this very day that aren't going to be able to do that. They live in food insecure households. 16 million of those people are children. And that's really, really crazy in my view. And it really speaks to the film that we're about to discuss. In November 2012, nearly 48 million people participated in the SNAP program. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps. And again, 45% of those folks are children. Now, Lori, let's start with you. Unlike most films, I'm hoping that we're not going to say that we can't talk about the stories in the films because it's coming out on March 1st.
No, we definitely can talk about them, for sure.
Yeah, cool. And by the way, March 1st is my late dad's birthday, who was a farmer. Who struggled with poverty himself. So I'm saying, after seeing the film, that people hear these stories and they're going to be compelled to see it for themselves. So you know, with all these folks living on SNAP benefits, I think it's important to say that to qualify for food stamps or SNAP benefits, a family of four can't earn a penny more than $28,000 a year. And that's amazing. Now, many people out there have these visions of people that are living on food stamps as gorging themselves on Twinkies and pounding 2-liter bottles of Coca-Cola, basically kind of getting obese on the backs of the American taxpayer. And they really feel that this is valid, that this is the truth. But Lori, your documentary tells a much different story. Why don't you break it down for us?
Well, I think you're right. There's a lot of misconceptions around SNAP and SNAP recipients. I think a lot of that dates back to, some of the stories that were generated back in the Reagan era, the idea of welfare queens, and we've got this sort of willingness as a country to always sort of look for who's getting a free ride, who's doing something unfair at our expense. The truth is that SNAP, as I understand it, has possibly the lowest fraud rate of any federal entitlement of any of them. It's estimated to be less than 1%, mostly because the barriers to entry are quite high. You have to do so many things to qualify for SNAP. You have to constantly prove that you don't have a bank account, you don't have a car, you don't have any extra income. It's quite onerous to even get on it in the first place. The idea of anybody trying to take advantage of it is kind of laughable when you find out. In some states, you need to be fingerprinted. I mean, it's almost like we criminalize people and stigmatize it so completely in a way that we don't stigmatize some of the other entitlements, like, say, Social Security. Nobody, takes your fingerprint so that you can get your benefits there. So I think it is one of those programs that is actually a terrific American success story. It's one of those programs that works, and when it is funded adequately, it has been shown to really erase the gap between families that are food insecure and will go part of the month without knowing how they're going to get food, and food security, having enough income, having enough cash to buy food. The truth is, and I think there's that you've sort of put two issues together a little bit, because the issue of what you buy with your SNAP dollars, or what you buy with your income, period, whether it is chips and soda or healthy items, is a separate issue altogether, and really has more to do with the affordability of certain foods over others.
No
and we
doubt.
Can definitely get into that. And if people tend to use their SNAP dollars for the wrong foods, it probably has more to do with the very low income and the need to make tough choices about what they can actually afford to bring in. The healthy food is just a lot more expensive. So that's a separate issue, I think.
Well, we've seen that. I have an organization, Wholesome Wave, and we work in communities of poverty, raising private money to double the value of SNAP benefits or food stamps when they're spent on locally grown fruits and vegetables. And we've learned that, you look at a head of broccoli in even the most inexpensive grocery store that you can buy broccoli from, and it's $2. And a six-pack of instant noodles is $2. And if you have a family of four and you're left near the end of the month after you run out of your SNAP benefits with $2 to spend on dinner for a family of four, do you put a head of broccoli in front of your four family members, or do you put a bowl of hot noodles? So it's interesting. What the question that I have for some is, I wonder if, like, the bank guys had to get fingerprinted to get, the bailouts. I couldn't resist. Anyway, it's interesting because that stigma is there. And there's a quote from the film that I want to bring out from Barbie from Philadelphia. Shout out to Philly. And Barbie is a mom living with two kids. She was on SNAP. And she said, "I feel like America has this stigma about how families are supposed to eat together at the table, but they don't talk about what it takes to get you there or what's there once you're actually at the table." And here's a mom that, when I was watching the film, is fixing herself a sandwich with two slices of salami, one slice of cheese on two pieces of bread, so that her two children could sit down at the kitchen table and split a can of Chef Boyardee ravioli. I mean, that's nuts. What amazed me about Barbie is that she did what so many Americans think about people living on food stamps: go get a job. Barbie actually did that. So why don't you tell us about that real quick?
Sure. So the woman in question, Barbara Izquierdo, she's really a terrific person. She is, as you mentioned, a young mother of two, and a really terrific mother. And her whole goal in life was to provide a healthy lifestyle for her kids, and to that end, she was working really, really hard, and her job was downsized. She lost her job and then proceeded to look for a new job, and while she was looking, she was entitled to SNAP benefits. And it was really tough because, as she explained it, the SNAP benefits would last about 2 to 3 weeks of the month, and for the rest of the month, she would just have to scramble and scrounge, and that was time she wasn't looking for work. She wasn't participating at her church or her community center or actually actively parenting. It was time that she was scrambling to get food into her kids on those days. It was really unproductive and very distressing and upsetting time. When she did get a job, now in the meantime, she had joined up with a group called the Witnesses to Hunger. The initial group was 40 North Philly moms who were documenting their struggles, feeding their families, and using the photographs to sort of give people a visual understanding of what it was like. They have taken their pictures all over the country. And in her activism, she managed to get a job at the Philadelphia Greater Council Against Hunger, counseling other people and helping them get benefits. This job paid her $12 an hour, which was a subsistence wage. It was what they could afford, and she, as a consequence of making that much money, was not able to get food stamps anymore. She was off the food stamps benefit because her income was too high, her income plus her benefits. She was no longer qualified to receive it, and as a consequence of getting this job and working really hard, her kids were hungrier, and in fact, because she was now employed, she lost their place at a subsidized daycare where they had been getting one or two healthy meals a day, and they were in the house all day, and they didn't have good food. And the scene that you described, where she's eating that sandwich, it's probably the only food she had all day, and her kids were eating a can of Chef Boyardee. It was the only thing she had in the house, and it was devastating.
Yeah, you know,
devastating to watch.
What was amazing to me was through her, all of that stuff of her telling her story, you never got the impression of somebody who was really psyched about trying to take advantage of a system.
Oh, God, no. She really was, and is,
because thankfully she's alive and well today and out there doing her thing and being a real hero. Of this message and changing the face, I think, of the SNAP recipient. But she really was talking about how much she loved her children, wanted to do the right thing. Now, I'm so stoked that you had Jan in the film, because she is just such an inspiration
to me.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about that era, where people were talking about the welfare queens, the very untrue stories of people driving up to the food stamp office in their Cadillacs and then going to the grocery store and loading up on T-bone steaks. So many of us know that that's just not true. Jan, you wrote an amazing book during that era in the 80s called Breadlines Knee Deep in Wheat. That title, to me, I almost think this today, tell us what's happened since the 80s. I'm almost feeling like maybe we're like Breadlines throat deep in wheat. Where do we stand?
Okay. In corn, you mean?
Yeah, corn. Oh, yeah, that's right. The commodities changed.
Would definitely be in corn. Well, just to clarify, that was a slogan during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Breadlines knee deep in wheat are surely the handiwork of foolish men. And it was a way of encapsulating the confusion and distress that Americans felt that so many were going hungry, and meanwhile there were enormous agricultural surpluses that were literally going to waste. The wheat was piled up on railroad sidings because the price had fallen so low that it didn't pay the farmer to ship it to market. And there were all kinds of stories of food crops being destroyed, kerosene poured over piles of oranges in California so that people couldn't eat them for free, so that there would be a market for the oranges that remained. It was a terrible time in our history. And this, what people experienced as a paradox or a contradiction of hunger, want amid plenty, is actually the origin of SNAP and WIC and all of our food assistance programs. I don't mean that they were all started during the Great Depression, but commodity distribution was started during the Great Depression, not only to families on relief, but eventually also to schools. And in that distribution of surplus commodities, the federal government began to take those commodities off the market as a way of supporting prices, and then they needed to transfer them to people and institutions who would not substitute them for other things they were buying. So they gave them to very poor people and to school food programs. And that's how the whole federal food assistance thing got started, and why it's in the Department of Agriculture, and why our food programs are overseen by the agriculture committees of the Congress and not. But when you fast forward to the current situation, One thing I have to say is, okay, first off, we're still dealing with some of the anomalies of commodities in food assistance. Recently, food banks have been asking the TFAP program, that stands for the Emergency Food Assistance Program, to make more purchases because food stamps are, food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens are feeling the pinch so much because food prices have gone up, so they're paying more for the portion of their food that they buy, and the need is so great, and so many people are turning to them. So they've been asking for more of the TFAP bonus commodities, and the Secretary of Agriculture has said, well, I can't buy more bonus commodities because the farm income is not in trouble.
and also it's not in trouble because so much of it is being turned into fuel, which is really pretty remarkable.
Part of it. But the great bulk of our food assistance activity in the United States, the SNAP program, the WIC program, does not any longer hinge on surplus commodities. So in a way, I think the new paradox, the new contrast is the one that you pointed to of diet-related disease visibly characterized by obesity, and people who are not getting the food that they need. And, you know, there are a substantial number of Americans who think, oh, well, if somebody's fat, they can't be hungry. But that's not, we have learned that that isn't true. If you eat a lot of high-calorie, nutrient-dense, to fill up foods that don't provide the nutrients you need, you will be hungry.
Oh, yeah. It is such a mind screw. I have two kids living with diabetes, so I understand how glucose production works, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But that's a great segue, because when we look at food insecurity and health and obesity, while seeming like an oxymoron, they're actually two sides of the same coin. I understand this when we look at the way that these highly processed calorie-dense foods work. Our body consumes maybe 50 calories to 70 calories of glucose an hour. Our cells need glucose. It's the only energy that they can use to divide and multiply. But if we eat a meal where it's 350 calories of those things, what our body doesn't take goes to fat stores. So an hour and a half later, a child is hungry, looking for more food, and you can't convert that fat back into the energy to allow your cells to divide and multiply. So it's interesting, Lori, there was a story that really touched me about Tremonica, an 8-year-old second grader in Mississippi who shocked this nurse practitioner doctor in a mobile health bus in Mississippi. And I want you to tell us the story of that. Where did the shock come from? Because it was palpable in the face of this woman when she asked Tremonica how old she was.
Well, for one thing, when Tremonica, I do want to say that it, Mississippi in the Delta region, it's the you know, we chose to shoot the film in the county that is simultaneously the most food insecure and also the obese, the has the greatest incidences of obesity. So that paradox is very much alive and well right where Tremonica is living.
Yeah, the grand oxymoron.
But to their credit, the educators and many of the health professionals in Mississippi and in the Delta region specifically are really addressing it head on and really doing some great stuff. And you see in the film that a mobile health unit is driving around to the different schools to talk to kids and work with them. And Tremonica comes into the mobile unit to talk to the nurse, and she looks as if she is approaching puberty, if not already in puberty, possibly even making her way out of puberty. She looks considerably older. She is pretty big. And the nurse says, "How old are you?" And she says, "Fixing to be 8, meaning she's 7. And the woman kind of says, "Fixing to be 8, and you can see that she's taking that in.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. The look on her face killed me.
All right,
it was unbelievable.
Tell me, honey, what did you have for breakfast this morning? And the little girl says, "Well, I didn't have any breakfast." And, you know, if anything, they go on to chat, but if anything really sort of sums it up, you know, that is it. Her mom, we actually spoke to her mom because we often hear from people that obesity and kids who have weight issues. It's obviously a failure of parenting is the sort of the consensus. But her mom is one of the better situated moms in the area. She has a job. She is a very caring mother and a devoted mom, and it's an area that's terribly depressed by this economy. There are no jobs. The jobs don't exist. And her mom has a job at a dollar store not too far away, and she is stretching her pennies. And she said straight up, If fruit is on sale, I'll buy it. But otherwise, I can't. I'll buy what's on sale. And what's on sale is always the cookies and the chips. That's what's on sale. And she is really concerned about her daughter's health and her daughter's weight. And the thing about this little girl is that, you know, it's so easy to just say, oh, here you go. Here's a little kid who just wants to, you know, eat crap. That's what kids do. But if you spent a little time with this kid, she is a math whiz. She has big dreams. She is a full human being with hopes and aspirations. And how does her eventual diabetes and terrible health that could be the consequence of what her mom can afford, well, where does that tie into all of her dreams and all of the future leadership that this kid is capable of? And it's a question we need to be asking ourselves as a country.
Yeah, and she's also cute as a button, by the way.
Cute, I mean, as just a button, the and
most beautiful smile.
And,
yeah. In other words, everybody, you got to see the movie.
In the Delta, we meet her teacher. Her second grade teacher is this wonderful woman named Ms. Odessa Cherry. I actually saw Ms. Cherry last week because we brought the film down to the Delta to show an audience there, people who had helped us with the film. And Ms. Cherry has the scene that steals everyone's heart in the film because she introduces the second grade to their first taste of honeydew melon. And it is so much fun to see how the kids react. And everybody always seems to comment about that scene because it's shocking and amazing, the reaction of kids when they're introduced to the right stuff. They get it's just, I don't even want to give it away.
Oh, no.
It's such
no,
a great scene.
Listen,
everyone laughs, and it leaves... It helps people leave the movie, I have to say, with a lightness in their step and an excitement and positivity, because they start to realize through that scene that there's great hope here. We can actually do this. Look at how excited kids are to be put on the right path.
Yeah.
And people say, God, I thought I'd be depressed, but I'm actually really excited. Yeah. I'm really happy. How can I get started?
It's remarkable, and there's so much tremendous hope because there are so many great school food programs out there here in New York City, Wellness in the Schools with my friend Bill Telepan, Ann Cooper doing really,
I hope you're listening.
Really, really amazing stuff. And you know, it's funny because when I was at the W Hotels back in the 90s, we did this thing with a middle school in the Bronx where I carved melon, flowers, and swans for this middle school class, and the kids like pounded the fruit salad. And then we got calls 2 days later from the principal of the school saying, I just want to let you know that all of the corner store owners are calling us and freaking out because these kids are going and demanding cantaloupes. And some of these owners don't even know what a cantaloupe is. It's like, it's amazing. But getting back to this thing of the two sides of the coin, Raj Patel, who's a good friend and said very eloquently, a lot of people think there is a gap between obesity and hunger. In fact, they are neighbors. Both are signs of having insufficient funds to command food you need to stay healthy. Now, Jan, as a sociologist, this has to drive you mad. It's got to drive you nuts. How do you explain it?
It does drive me nuts. Well, I think I want to start by saying the poor in the United States are poorer than they've ever been. They are farther from the middle. Because our poverty line is really obsolete and based on assumptions that no longer hold, they're further out of the mainstream. But we also have many, many, many more families now living at incomes below half the federal poverty threshold.
Yeah, over 50%. Yeah. And let me, just the numbers for you listeners. Poverty defined in today's standards is a family of four on a family income of $28,000, more than 58% people live at less than half that level. So we have millions of families of four trying to make ends meet on $14,000 a year. Just to put it in perspective, please continue. Sorry about that.
And by more than half of people, you mean, or 58% of the officially poor.
Of the officially poor, that's correct, Nutty.
Yeah. And in the current SNAP program, fully 20% have no other income, no income at all, no cash income at all. They're trying to get by on, you know, sleeping on other people's couches and their SNAP benefits. So I think we have to start by understanding how poor many American poor people are. So they have no choices, in a sense. They've got to take what can be given to them. They need to take their SNAP benefits and get as much food as they can because that's all there is.
Yeah, it's amazing. Our team was talking before this, and it's almost like for those that really don't understand what poverty is, you know, $28,000 for people that live in Fairfield, Connecticut, where I'm from, that's their mortgage. You know, so can your mortgage feed a family of four? And we just have a couple of minutes left, but Lori, you know, I need you to, you know, Tom Colicchio, who is one of the executive producers of the film, said there has got to be a way where produce is made accessible and less expensive than it is now. This is one of the biggest problems we face. Lori, tell us the truth in these last couple of minutes. What was it like working with your husband on this film? I just have
to ask. Well, it was like just like every other day of our lives, because we work on everything together. You know, we're kind of really nosy, and we're always in each other's business. So to be really honest, it was like, you know, he was going to be working on it whether he liked it or not. So why not give him the executive producer credit and let him actually go out and do something for the film, which he did. And it was great. He does not take direction very well, I have to say.
He's a chef. What do you expect?
That was often a problem. But he was able to do what he does, which is he's an incredibly plain-spoken person and very direct. What you see is what you get. I think that's why people have responded so well to him on Top Chef. I don't think he's not some, you know, fancy guy, even if some of his restaurants are. And I think he's able to speak about this issue from a place of genuine concern. You know, his mom, my mother-in-law, who I adore, was a lunch lady. She managed a cafeteria in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where Tom grew up, for many, many years. And when she was ready to retire, she didn't want to retire because she was worried. She had spent many years kind of working the system and using her relationships and fighting to get even a little bit of healthy food in front of these kids, however she could, by hook or by crook. And the idea of retiring and leaving it to a newbie to try to figure out what she had figured out, she didn't want to do it because, as she said, you know, some of these kids, this is the only meal they're getting.
Yeah, it's so amazing.
And so for Tom, it sort of hit him at that moment like a ton of bricks. You know, it's very real to him. And for both Tom and I, we grew up in very loving families, very supportive families, where food really was love. And we have so many amazing childhood memories that are connected to food and family celebrations. And it kind of breaks my heart when I think about, you know, 17 million children in this country are not going to have that, don't have that kind of warm grounding around something that we very much have taken for granted. So long answer, but working with him was kind of like being married to him. Is a pleasure most of the time.
Good. Most of the time. Well, you know,
most of the time.
I have to tell you, as a chef also, what I love about Tom is just he speaks from a place of good old-fashioned common sense.
Yeah,
and, you know, very proud of him and very proud of you, Lori, for the work that you're doing. So I want to thank you so much for joining us, you know, today on It's More Than Food. And when we come back, Jan and I are going to really sink our teeth into solutions because we think we need to get there, you know, and I do love the film. It airs March 1st now. Anywhere in particular, where should people watch for this first?
Well, the great thing is that it's opening up in about 30 different cities.
Cool.
You can go on to Magnolia Pictures website or to Participant Media's websites, or you can go to www.takepart.com/table to learn more. And it also is coming out on iTunes and on demand the same day, so that if you're not in one of those places that has an art house theater that shows documentaries, you still can see it. You can see it right when it hits. But the thing I think that we're most proud about, and I'm speaking also for my co-director, Christy Jacobson, because I don't want to take all the credit. I had an amazing co-director who was a very celebrated documentary filmmaker, and she couldn't be here today, but I speak for her too. One of the things that we are most proud of is that Participant Media will be launching on March 1st a National Action Center around hunger that will be bringing together
awesome.
All the different national hunger groups, all the local groups, all the food pantries, all the food banks, all the activists out there under one central place, so that you could go online, put in your area, your zip code, and find out exactly what you could do today, now, to end hunger.
Awesome.
In your neighborhood and even nationally. And it is really exciting. This is going to be a multi-year plan, and they are sinking their teeth into it. I hope people go see the movie and then get on the website and see how they can get involved. It can be ended. We can do it.
Well, Lori, one more thing. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Lori. Happy birthday to you. It's your birthday.
Great job. Thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah,
guys.
And listen, great luck on the film. We love you. We're proud of you guys. And again, when we come back, me and Jam, Pop and Dink, sinking our teeth into solutions, because it's more than food on Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You better do what you want when you get up in the morning, 'cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet. Just plan our hand till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too. Oh, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too. You're lazy, but you just might find it's them that's crazy. I'm just raising them rats. I'm making dough get fat, hanging up their hat. No, we ain't living like that. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they?
So welcome back to It's More Than Food. I am your host, Michelle Nishan. This is our first ever airing on the one and only Heritage Radio Network. And thank you so much for listening in and joining us. And with me right here, right now, in this very place at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, is the one and only Janet Papendieck. And Janet, not only is she an amazing professor of sociology at City University for Hunter College, but she is the author of three amazing books, one of which we discussed earlier, Breadlines Knee Deep in Wheat, which was written in the mid-80s, but also in Sweet Charity, which is kind of a groundbreaking examination of emergency food relief programs in the United States. And in the book, she suggests a shift in focus from simply feeding the hungry to preventing the hungry from becoming hungry in the first place. And she challenges food providers to work towards creating systemic change. So this is the part of the show where we really want to talk about solutions, Jen. Talk about Sweet Charity. Talk about the work in there, and really talk about your particular view from everything that you've learned from what's really a remarkable career in following this subject.
Okay. Well, I got interested in the whole emergency food phenomenon, soup kitchens and food pantries and food banks, when I participated with some colleagues in a study that was done for the New York State Department of Health. They wanted to know whether clients at food pantries were substituting this for benefits like what we now call SNAP and used to call food stamps, or whether they were turning up at food pantries in addition to getting their SNAP benefits. And I hired a team of students from Hunter College to do, because we needed to do hundreds and hundreds of interviews. It was a sample-based thing. And while they were doing the interviews, I talked to the staff and the directors. Maybe I wanted to distract them a little bit from but in any case, I became very interested in this phenomenon and in these people who had, for the most part, been drawn in to creating a food pantry or a soup kitchen in the early 1980s with the idea that this was a temporary emergency and that they were going to do this for a couple of years and then it would be done.
Right, because the economy would turn around and people would be back to work.
The early 1980s was the Rust Belt recession, the one where a lot of the big industries in the Middle West
steel and
went
all
under.
Right.
And it was also a recession in which the federal government did something fairly unprecedented, which was they cut back on social safety net supports during a recession. Something that's known in the trade as OBRA, the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Acts of 1981 and 1982, made really substantial cuts in our society's supports for low-income people in the housing field, in food assistance, and in the little bit of cash assistance that we were then giving out. So you had, in a way, the federal government aggravating the suffering from the recession. And Ronald Reagan was in office, and he was a great believer that it was the job of private charity to meet people's needs, that government should be doing less. And
the whole 1,000 points of lights thing.
Right.
We can find enough people in communities to handle this problems out of charity, and the government shouldn't be involved, basically. Right.
Exactly. So a lot of people, either enthusiastically or reluctantly, responded to that call by creating neighborhood-based soup kitchens and food pantries. And, as I say, thought that they would be doing this for a year or two. And when I was talking to them, it had been a decade for many of them. And there was no end in sight, no likelihood that we were going to be able to go out of the emergency food business or the charitable food business. So I undertook a study, and it involved kind of going around the country and talking to people and volunteering here and there where I could and talking to clients and to volunteers and to providers. And many of the directors wanted to introduce me to a volunteer who had formerly been a client. And that was always an inspiring story. Many people who have benefited want to give back and help others. But the more I pondered what was going on here, the more I wondered if we weren't distracting ourselves, diverting ourselves from the underlying causes, the mounting inequality. This was when a lot of us first began to pay attention to the rate at which inequality was increasing in the United States. If you had told me then that it would keep increasing and accelerate its increase until 2013, I don't think I would have believed it. As a nation, we decreased inequality. We grew together from the end of World War II until the late 1970s or the mid-1970s. And then we began growing apart, and we have been growing apart ever since. But maybe I'll come back to inequality a little later.
Well, it's interesting because I just want to highlight that for a moment, because there is this, it's just a terrible misnomer, because we hear about it, this kind of fear-mongering of the redistribution of wealth. What you're really talking about is that from the mid-70s, a tremendous amount of wealth was redistributed from the middle class to the wealthy class. So there's already been a redistribution of wealth as a result of some loopholes that you need some pretty clever, expensive lawyers to help you figure out. But when you do that, you can actually increase your income 5, 10, 100, 1,000-fold. So this redistribution has happened. So when we actually look at talking about returning you know, the right of the middle class to actually have an opportunity to earn a fair income, one where they can feed their families and be self-reliant. It's not a redistribution of wealth. It's actually taking back or a redistribution of wealth back to where it belonged in the first place when we were a very healthy nation.
Right. You could almost say that it's a conservative policy in the sense that it's returning us to a period when we were more healthy economically, our economy was in better shape, and socially.
Yeah.
But to continue a little bit with this saga of emergency right. food programs and soup kitchens yes. and food pantries, I think as I pondered all this, the thing that troubled me most was a perception that not so much for the people who were deeply involved, who were dedicating themselves to running this, but for all the casual donors. Mm. Kitchens and pantries and food banks raise a lot of their resources by interaction with the public, by having a canned good drive. You know, the scouts do scouting for food in the fall, and the
yes.
letter carriers collect in the spring, and there are concerts that you get into by bringing a can, or you're asked mm-hmm, to make. Mm-hmm. There was just canstruction in New York, where architects compete. So this became very pervasive in our culture, so a lot of people were doing a little something against hunger, and I think feeling better. And that's mm-hmm. where I came up with the notion that one of the ways emergency food affects our culture is as a kind of moral safety valve. Mm. It makes us feel better about. And I loved being a part of Laurie's and Christie's movie. And I hope the movie is really going to raise the hunger issue again. Mm. But I hope that people won't stop with putting a can in the canned good drive or making a small donation, because they mm. need to move on to issues like the level of the minimum wage.
Mm.
Wages in general have stagnated and fallen in the lower sections. It's not sustainable. The wage levels in our society, we need to pay people better.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a restaurant in Westport, Connecticut. It's called The Dressing Room. And we were talking about this, me and the Wholesome Wave team, before the show, and you know we pay our dishwashers $10.50 an hour, and it's interesting because you know even some chef friends of mine at the beginning said, "Are you nuts?" And I said, "Well, no, it works. It's not. I'm not doing it, you know, because I'm what some people would call a flaming liberal. It's actually business common sense." You know, you pay somebody a really good wage, and then we also do something that's very unorthodox. We schedule overtime. So we have a theater next door. So 5 to 6 months out of the year, we're really busy. 3 months out of the year, we're kind of busy. And 3 months out of the year, we're pretty slow. So what happens is, instead of hiring more people during the busy time and then laying them off, which creates all kinds of havoc in the systems that we're talking about, we actually will schedule somebody 48 to 52 hours a week. And then 3 months out of the year, there are 30 hours a week, but they end up making enough money to where a dishwasher is making close to $30,000 a year. But I never hear a dish break. I never hear a glass break. Everything is incredibly clean. They get more done in less time because the employees will stay put when they're making a fair wage. And when we look at that translating across what happens in my restaurant, less food gets thrown away, less food gets burnt, less food gets wasted. Everybody's in a rhythm. They're a team. They become a family. The efficiencies of not hiring and retraining new staff and laying people off and paying unemployment more than pay themselves back just by raising the wage a little bit. So to me, helping people understand that raising the minimum wage is not going to put Papa John's out of business. You know, it's just, it's a ridiculous notion, but we've lost that fair wage for a fair day's pay, right?
And we've also lost the idea that employees are an important part of...
I mean, work, sorry about that, yeah.
But an important part of the business
mm-hmm.
community, the business entity. So the you're talking about a process in which an employee joins the dressing room and builds skill.
Mm.
You know, they become better and better at what they do. They yeah. learn from
our pastry chef started as a dishwasher from Peru.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's really terrific. Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of the human experience and the experience mm-hmm. of work and being sure. part of the community and being settled in the community and having their kids in school and they can stay in the same school. I mean, this is good for our society. It's good for the individuals who are getting a fair wage, and it's good for the business owner, from what I'm hearing you say.
Absolutely.
But it's also really good for communities because, and you have people who are engaged and committed and want the best future for them.
Well,
community.
It actually gives people of diverse ethnicity an opportunity to be able to become part of the community. They don't have to live on the dark side of town because that's the only rent that they can afford.
Right.
It's really interesting. Now, sociologically, I want to get back to this point that you were talking about because, you know, it never crossed my mind until you said it right here today on the show. And that's this whole thing that, you know, you give the cans of food or you give the turkey on Thanksgiving or whatever it is, and you feel almost, or what you're saying, it almost creates kind of like a false sense of security that the problem has gotten solved because you've made that donation, but that's right. not necessarily the case.
Right. You feel better, so you quit worrying about hunger and you get on with your life. Something engaged you in the first place, or, you know, you have a kid in the scouts or something and somebody, but it's quick and done with and over with. And it's a very great distortion to think that the soup kitchen food pantry sector of food assistance is making a very big difference. I'm glad that those people are doing that work because people would be suffering even more. Mm. But Bread for the World just calculated that it's 1 out of 26 assisted
wow.
meals is a private charitable meal. And the other 25 out of 26 are public sector, are
yeah.
either the SNAP program or the TFAP commodities that end up in some of the soup kitchens. So it's really only a tiny portion of what needs to be done.
And I know. Well, here's the number on it. It's 1 in 8 people. And I'm not crazy about the word, get help at food banks.
Mm-hmm.
1 in 8 people actually rely on food banks, right? 37 million Americans in 2010 relied on food banks to feed their families. They relied on them. It wasn't, you know, I didn't get work this week. I'm single. I'm homeless. I'm going to go to a food bank and get some hot soup, and then I'm going to go out and panhandle. I mean, these are often families that we see that where between the husband and the wife or the caregivers, they have sometimes a combination of 4 part-time jobs that don't equal a full-time wage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's remarkable.
Right. And it's also the case that I am a big supporter of SNAP, formerly known as food stamps. I think we couldn't get along without it, given attitudes toward cash assistance in this society. But SNAP benefits don't last the month for most recipients or most participants. And it's because SNAP was actually never designed to be to meet the total food needs of a family. It's designed to meet the food needs of a family after you spend 30% of your disposable income on food.
On food, right, yeah.
And so a lot of people who don't have that 30% available to spend on food because rents are much higher than they were when that structure was created, because there are all kinds of expenses in our society now that didn't even exist when that structure was created, those families are often turning to food banks and food pantries to fill out the month.
God, that's remarkable. So it sounds like we're getting back into the problem. But it's so unavoidable because it's so huge. But, you know, I want to point out a couple of really neat things about the SNAP program. And, you know, George W. Bush was a hero of mine on this issue, because he fully funded a study through the United States Department of Agriculture during his term that showed $1 in food stamp spend created $1.83 at USDA. And then Mark Zandi, the most conservative economist and really truthful guy, I mean, he is an excellent data cruncher, right? Went after it and found that it was $1.77. So one food stamp dollar creates $1.77 in GDP. So I think the good news about the program is it really can't be looked at as much as a subsidy. I mean, when you look at direct payments to cotton, rice, corn, soy, wheat, the transportation subsidies that aren't part of the Department of Agriculture, the new markets tax credits that some of these large facilities benefit from to build these massive processing facilities that don't really provide good paying jobs for many of the workers there. Those are subsidies because they really don't result in immediate jobs or impact. And it's not food that's spent into a system where somebody, as thinly as it's spread, even if they're buying instant noodles, someone who's holding on to a SNAP or food stamp dollar goes to a store and they buy that cup of noodles. It's money in the system now. It pays for the lighting bill at the corner store. It pays for some of the salary of the cashier. It pays for the salary of the truck driver. It was a brilliant study because it actually broke down how many trucking jobs the program supports. So the good news is we shouldn't be cutting SNAP at all, right? I mean, we need to keep, not only do we need to keep it whole, but, you know, we need to look at solutions that can actually shift the way that money gets spent on higher value food. So we're doing this thing, you know about it, Chan, at Wholesome Wave, where we double the value of food stamps when they're spent on locally grown fruits and vegetables at farmers markets. And we all know that farmers at farmers markets often are on food stamps themselves, or they're working off farm income. And what we've seen is people on food stamps, the folks who are supposed to be pounding Twinkies and guzzling bottles of Coke, actually flocking to the markets. I have one story, and I want to ask you your view of this as a sociologist, because you may not have heard a story like this. In Bridgeport 3 years ago, there was an African-American man, wonderful, jolly, jolly, beautiful man with a smile and definitely overweight, came with the three children he was caring for, who were the three children of his deceased sister, which is not uncommon in these communities, saw kohlrabi, picked it up, waved it over his head, saying, "Excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, somebody tell me what to do with this because I can afford it." Huh. And he bought 10 pounds. The farmer was so happy because even in affluent white communities, people don't want to ask a question. They don't want to seem dumb. So kohlrabi sits and rots at the farmers markets. Something that this man didn't know how to cook actively seeked out the education necessary to be able to take it home and feed those children. What does that say to you?
It says we have a lot of distorted stereotypes about low-income people in this country, and that many people will seek to feed their families as, I mean, I think most people will try to feed their families as well as they can. I don't think we should overstate it. There are people out there who haven't gotten the message yet about how much unhealthy food. I mean, I grew up assuming that if I went to the store and bought stuff, it would be good for me. I think there are people who haven't gotten quite figured out how much we are flooded with non-nutritious, not valuable food. But most people want to do the best they can for their families and their kids. And so if we make the information available, I love the cooking demonstrations at farmers markets, and they seem to be well attended. I would still like that guy to have a good enough, reliable income that he could choose a large part of his vegetables from the ones he knows and loves.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that a little bit, because we do know, and I know you and I are likely on the same page with some of this. When we look at farmers markets, there are only so many of them, even though they've gone from, you know, a few thousand just 5 years ago to close to 8,000 today. That's progress. They still probably make up less than, you know, 2% of all food access in the country. So it's a small venue. And then, you know, community gardens popping up all over the place, and a lot of folks saying, well, you know, that's quaint and that's nice that people in underserved communities and urban areas and even rural areas are growing their own food, but you're never going to achieve scale. So there's a lot of resistance by lobbies where there have been efforts by the USDA and some of our more forward-thinking legislators to steer more dollars in federal grant dollars to establishing urban farming. They're fighting it, saying it's not scale. But in 1943, Daniel Bowman Simon did some research for us. So we wrote this policy paper that really took some stuff out of your book, you know, bread lines knee deep in wheat. And in 1943, Franklin Roosevelt gave a speech where he said that in 1942, 48% of all fresh food consumed by Americans, this is in the days when USDA actually did study where food came from, came from privately held Victory Gardens. So in 1942, we were almost at half of our population. So if those same gardens today were in production, arguably 25% of the fresh food consumed in the United States would be coming from privately held Victory Gardens. That sounds pretty scalable to me. So I'm wondering if when we start to look at, steer the notion of small farms, farmers markets, community gardens away from boutique and say, you know, instead of everything being giant, we're always going to need some giant because there are places that feed 5,000 people a day. Mid-size is almost completely gone. So I think we need less giant, a whole bunch more mid-size, and tens of thousands more small things, right? And in tens of thousands more small things, that's where I think these job opportunities exist. Food trucks. Why can't a food truck belong to an underserved community member as a business opportunity through a microfinance fund or whatever? So, I mean, what are your thoughts of that, Jan? Some of these communities are so devastated by poverty, and it almost seems so behind the eight ball in the education that's available to them because of budget cuts is just so egregiously bad. Could we make these things happen?
Well, I think the green carts in New York are a pretty good example of not only increasing access to fresh fruits and vegetables in low-income communities, but creating jobs for a lot of those jobs went to people who had been on the edge of need themselves.
Well, you know, and there's another cool film there because of the apple pushers, the Lorium Tisch Illumination Fund funded the Green Cart Initiative. And I think they today at the event we were at earlier, they said 500 green carts providing 900 jobs. And we saw these stories of immigrants who had come in to apply for these licenses that actually saw the value in being able to own their own businesses so great that it really caused them to become legal residents of the United States. They got their citizenship during the course of the time that the film was being made. And I think that's a remarkable thing because when you look at opportunity, you know, we look at the problems right now, the big issues aside from, you know, gun control, you know, immigration reform. Everybody's looking at each and every one of these problems as a single individual thing, and they almost affix a stereotype to the people that are suffering from it, not realizing that if you actually create an opportunity, that somebody actually will see the value and work hard to play by the rules and become a legal citizen, they'll have a green card, open a business, be self-reliant, and then hire people to run their green cards, because there were like five stories in that film that were just terrific. I mean,
yeah. Great. So that's a model that we can try and
it's one, right?
And replicate and apply to other, to other bright ideas, other efforts to create access to food. One of my favorites is the idea that we should be doing more fresh cooking in our schools, and we should have universal free school meals. And you just have to give me 30 seconds on universal free school meals.
You got more than 30 seconds.
We waste so much money on qualifying kids for free, reduced price or full price, and managing the data. And, you know, every single meal in the school lunch and breakfast program has to be accounted for as to which category it belongs in. Was it fed to a kid who eats free, or one who should pay reduced price, or one who has to pay the full price? It's a crazy measurement system. There are many, many errors made in certifying kids, so that there are kids who are eligible to eat free who are being charged the reduced price, or eligible for the reduced price being charged the full price. And then there's some errors made in the other direction. So if we could move to healthy meals, and there have been great movements in the direction of improving the quality of school food, if we did more scratch cooking has the effect of transferring a job from some factory halfway across the country to our own community.
Well, and externalizing the costs of all of that stuff, right?
And so if we would need to employ more people in the cafeterias. And these are jobs that are so important in low-income communities because they are jobs on the school schedule. So anywhere where you have large numbers of parents who are struggling to raise their children without the support of a partner, and we have a lot of that in the United States, a job on the school calendar is a huge blessing.
Oh, and it's right in the middle of these. And it sounds to me, when you describe the I'm a businessman, so I know what it costs to measure things and to manage things and who gets what. And it's like doing menus and, let's do the math someday on that. And it sounds to me like it would be the same cost or maybe even less expensive to just provide that lunch to everybody. And then obviously from a sociology perspective, what that does for self-esteem, because you don't have, ooh, those are the free lunch kids and these are the normal kids. You know, it's just all of a sudden everybody's just a kid, right? Remarkable.
And the food becomes a bringing together phenomenon in the school day. You're not, you know, there's not that class division in the cafeteria to some extent. I think it's a much saner way to do it. And they are doing it now in Brazil. They've been doing it in Sweden for decades and decades. They're doing it in most of Japan. I mean, it's not that it can't be done. Mm. People are fond of saying no such thing as a free lunch. Well, there is no such thing as a free lunch, but the choice of who pays for it, that's our choice to make. Yeah. And we could do it in a sane and rational way. We don't have to do it in this crazy, unproductive way.
Well, that's fabulous. I say move over Sarah Palin and Hillary Rodham Clinton. Jan Papendieck for president. We're going to solve all of our problems. That's all there is to it. You know, it's remarkable, Jan. I really am hoping that you're going to continue your work and continue writing and sharing and come back onto the program, because I just want to let folks know that the farm bill last year that actually contains the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps, and so many other supports for local, regional farmers. All the food that hits our table is affected by this bill. And the first time since the 1930s, that bill was allowed to expire. So one of the things that we're going to really focus on this year in each of our programs as we come into the summer is the reintroduction of the farm bill, because the Senate wants to take this farm bill as written and put it back on the floor. And there are issues that we need to deal with. And there's some enlightening stuff that we want to do. And we want to really engage the listeners to really kind of take their government back by not just voting every 4 years, but really being engaged in the process and doing stuff. Would you come back?
I would come back. And if I can have a parting shot here.
Do your parting shot.
I'd just like
you
to,
own it.
To go back to the film for a minute, to A Place at the Table, which I think everyone should run right out and see. Definitely go see it. But after you've seen it, don't think about the poor as them. Think about, you know, think about the 99%. We're all in this food system, and we're all vulnerable to being harmed by a food system that pushes us toward unhealthy choices or takes money that we need. So go see the film and then think about what kind of food system do we really want, and how can we have one that has a place for everyone at the table.
Well, and how these neighbors that are suffering from this poverty can become heroes of a changed food system, right?
Hear, hear.
Yeah, we really believe that can happen. Well, listen, thanks for being here, Jan. I'm Michelle Nashan. It's More Than Food. We're going to be back in about a month or so listen for us. Get engaged, get involved, listen in, support Heritage Radio Network, and happy Valentine's Day. Love each other through food, and it's going to be a better world. Thanks for listening.
Gotta get started.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I got two shoes, I got a coat, I got my hands, I got some hope to make me a sustainable life. I need to move steady.